Yes, thank you. So thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. So we need to talk about morphogens. So this cartoon, so for me this is sort of the principal question, the main question in developmental biology. Sort of everything else is sort of detail and elaboration. So what we really want to understand is how you go from a small collection of equivalent equipotent cells to a tissue containing many more cells, and those cells are different from one another, and they're organized in a particular manner. So there's sort of three things going on there. There's some kind of growth, so controlled proliferation. There's differentiation, so you're making different cells, but there's also an organization to that, a pattern formation. So you're growing and differentiating cells in some kind of organized spatial and temporal manner. And so that's what I would like to understand. So we think about this problem then, we can sort of break this down. So sort of the fundamental assumption we have is that different cell types are represented by different gene expression profiles. So the problem becomes one of understanding how you regulate, how you generate differential spatial patterns of gene activity within a tissue. So we think about that then, what's required is some kind of symmetry breaking event, some kind of spatial polarization. That has to be then communicated across the field of cells to provide position information to tell cells in some way where they are within that tissue. And then that position information needs to be converted into discrete domains of gene expression to give you those spatial patterns of gene expression that we think of as the correlates for pattern formation, developmental pattern formation. And of course, one solution to that problem is the concept of a morphogen. So here's my sort of introduction to what I think is sort of, you know, commonly perceived view, the textbook view of what a morphogen is. So it's some kind of long-range signal, normally a protein signal, a secreted protein of some sort, but doesn't have to be, of course. But a long-range signal emanating from a localized source, either within a tissue or adjacent to a tissue, and thereby forming a concentration gradient. So that concentration now becomes a correlate of position. So if you know the concentration, you know how far you're away from the source of the morphogen. And that information is used by cells in some way to control differential gene expression that underlies the acquisition of cell type identity. So we'd like to know how you generate a long-range signal, so how you generate a gradient of a signal, how cells perceive that signal, and how that is converted into discrete domains of gene expression. So what I want to do is talk about that, but first of all, in the first couple of minutes, I just want to sort of briefly reintroduce some common systems, some common tissues that are used for the study of morphogens, which you'll see in the literature all the time. And I want to do that because I want to make a couple of points about them as we go through that. So of course, we're all very familiar with early patterning in Drosophila embryos and the idea that a gradient of bicoid, so high bicoid anterior, decreasing as you move posteriorly, is responsible for establishing anterior-posterior polarity and controlling the expression of stripes of genes along the AP axis of the early Drosophila embryo. I'm sure, Hernan, you're going to talk about this some more.
I don't think I'm talking.
You're not talking? But I'm sure you must have already seen this already in the course. So the two points I want to make about this is, I think this is quite an unusual system for two reasons. So first of all, the early Drosophila embryo, as we heard yesterday, is a syncytium. So there are no membranes dividing cells in this. So it allows the unhindered spread of a transcription factor, bicoid, through the tissue. So that's quite unusual. And the second, I think, distinctive feature of BitCoid or early AP patterning in Drosophila embryos, which actually may be related to its syncytial nature, is the speed at which this happens. So this happens within about the first hour of development, and in fact, this gradient of BitCoid establishes this pattern within a matter of minutes, within sort of, what is it, 40 minutes or so, would be the sort of the key window for development. So it's a very fast process. So it's a syncytium, and it's quick. So another system I'm sure you're all familiar with that's used a lot to study morphogens is a Drosophila wing disk. And in particular, there's two orthogonally acting graded signals in the wing disk. So DPP along the AP boundary is responsible for establishing patterns of gene expression along the AP axis, which later determines where wing veins will form in the adult fly. And then along the orthogonal dorsal ventral axis, Wnt signaling again is responsible for patterns of gene expression along the DV axis, which again will establish things such as the margin bristles in the mature wing disk. So in contrast to Drosophila embryos, this is an epithelial tissue, so this is a very structured, pseudostratified epithelial tissue with genuine cells in there. And this process is also much longer. So this process of pattern formation, or this process of wing disk formation, pattern formation, takes several days. Again, Marcus, what's the timing here? So 3 or 4 days? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in contrast to minutes, now we're up at sort of days timescale. So those are two examples you see a lot in the literature from invertebrates, from Drosophila. So a couple of examples from vertebrates. So we've also heard something about this already. So mesoderm induction here, I'm taking the example of frog embryos, which again are a well-established model for this. And in the frog embryo, TGF-beta signals emanating from the vegetal pole are responsible for inducing mesoderm in a ring of cells around the forming embryo, and different levels of signal are responsible for inducing different types of mesoderm. So here, this tissue is not an epithelium, it's more mesenchymal-like, and the cells are actually intermixing and moving quite a lot during this period of mesoderm induction. And in this case, in frog embryos, sort of the time scale here is of the order of a small number of hours, so perhaps 2 or 3 hours. So again, we're sort of intermediate between Drosophila AP patterning and Drosophila wing disk patterning. But the cell structure, the cell biology here is very different. It's mesenchymal rather than sort of a structured epithelium. And finally, I want to mention neural tube patterning, and this is the example, this is the system I study, and is the example I'll be using mainly as we go into the talk. So in the vertebrate central nervous system, the neural tube forms early in development, and it's at these early stages of patterning, it's a pseudostratified epithelium, more similar to the wing disk than the other tissues I've just introduced to you. And the early neural tube is patterned along its ventral to dorsal axis by signals emanating from the ventral and dorsal poles. And I'm going to mostly focus on hedgehog signaling emanating from the ventral pole, the foreplate, and the notochord. And this establishes domains of gene expression arrayed along the dorsal ventral axis, each of which generates distinct neuronal subtypes. And is responsible for these neuronal subtypes, responsible for assembling the functioning neural circuits that allow us to perceive and respond to external environment. So, again, thinking about the cell biology here, it's a pseudostratified epithelium, so it's more structured than the mesenchyme. And this, the time scale here is so in chick and mouse. This will take about 24 to 48 hours, slightly longer in humans. in zebrafish. It's a slightly shorter period of time. So we think about these four examples. So the common theme in here is that each of these establishes a pattern along a particular axis in response to a signal emanating from a localized source. But if we start to think about the cell biology and the timescales here, there's quite a lot going on. So very fast syncytial to much slower pseudostratified, much slower, more structured tissue here. But I think it's interesting just to remember that when thinking about sort of the principles and mechanisms that may be operating here. What are those constraints? How do those constrain the possible mechanisms operating in each of these different tissues? Okay, having sort of introduced you, mentioned those, and let's get back to thinking about this problem of morphogen gradients and the interpretation of morphogen gradients. So I think we can break this down into sort of four questions. So first of all, it's just sort of the basic genetics. So we'd like to identify what the morphogen is, where the morphogen is coming from. I'm not going to talk about that today at all. I want to just briefly sort of summarize and mention some stuff about how a graded signal can be formed, so the mechanisms of intercellular transmission. So how, what are the questions about how a morphogen spreads through a tissue to form a gradient? And then really what I most want to focus on is this, the last two things here. So how do cells perceive the gradient? So how does a cell communicate an extracellular concentration across the membrane through a signal transduction pathway? And how does that result in differential gene expression? And how is that interpreted? So how do you go from a continuous gradient, a concentration gradient, how do you convert that into discrete all or none changes in gene expression that must underlie the discrete assignment of cell identity? But first of all, let me just tell you something about sort of my take on questions about the formation, the spread of morphogens. So we think about this again just very simply. It's sort of the simplest possible mechanisms by which a gradient can form. You can think of it involving three sort of distinct processes. So first of all, some cells must be producing the signal, the morphogen, at some rate, so a flux of the morphogen into the tissue. Then it has to spread through the tissue. And again, just thinking about the simplest possible mechanism, then some kind of diffusive random walk process is probably the simplest we can think about. So just the idea that the molecules are behaving in a random isotropic way to spread from their source. And then the third activity is some kind of removal of the morphogen from the tissue. So that could be, for example, extracellular degradation, but it could also involve the binding to receptors internalization and then either the trapping of the morphogen or the degradation of the morphogen in the cell. So if we think about each of those, then the production gives you some flux of molecules into the tissue. Then a simple random walk process can explain the spread of that through the tissue. And then some kind of uniform degradation, uniform removal of the ligand from the tissue. And taking those assumptions, then it's straightforward to start to describe this using diffusion equations. And I'm not going to go into this at all today, but there's a very nice review by Marcus which describes this in very clearly and in a lot more detail. And so this gives you sort of the simplest possible description of how a signal could spread through a tissue. But when you start to think about this again from the biological perspective, then things get more complicated. So the simplest possible mechanism of spread would just be diffusion in isotropic diffusion in a uniform volume. And of course, that's a gross oversimplification. The tissues have cells within them. Those will form, those will increase the tortuosity of the tissue. In addition, there's binding and unbinding, transient binding to extracellular matrix to cell surface components, which will again further complicate, further increase the complexity of what's going on. And Alex Scheer and Patrick Muller have written a very nice, fairly recent review about this. So again, the important thing to notice here, though, is that as long as the effect of these additional processes doesn't affect the sort of the random walk aspect of morphogen spread, then they can still be described by that simple diffusion equation. And of course, there can be even further complications where cells take up the morphogen and resecrete it as it's being spread through the tissue in processes such as transcytosis. And of course, even further complications such as cellular processes within the tissue affecting the movement of the morphogen. But again, as long as these are isotropic and can be equated to a random walk, then they're still equivalent to a simple diffusive process. But I think there's lots of interesting questions here that at that interface between sort of cell biology and molecular mechanism. And it's really only in fairly recent years that the imaging is approaching the necessary resolution where we can really begin to ask these questions. So, you know, really to address these questions, we need techniques that give us, you know, close to single molecule resolution, time-lapse imaging of single molecules over long periods of time in order to really distinguish between various cell biological mechanisms. And I'm sure Marcus would be very happy to talk about this in much greater detail if you're interested. So that's all I wanted to say about intercellular transmission and formation of morphogen gradients. Really what I want to spend the rest of the time on is this interpretation question. So how are cells perceiving a morphogen gradient and how are they converting that information into discrete domains of gene expression?
So I had a question about the formation, and particularly about the equations you'll be using. What about the situation like for the dorsal gradient in EV axis formation in Drosophila, where you have a uniform intracellular source, but you have an external cue activating it in a concentration-dependent manner? Would you then...
Say again, so the
external source, like the toll signaling, is activating the intracellular transduction of dorsal, but dorsal we think of as the morphogen, and that is uniformly expressed. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, so this becomes... I mean, I would class that as a semantic issue.
But,
right,
like,
so, and I think we can come back and discuss that. So what is a morphogen? And I think as we go on, this will become even more complicated.
Yeah, it's not about the class. I was just meaning about here, how would we look at describing this? Do you have to take into account or treat the extracellular activation of the source? Because it's not diffusion of something from a location. It is a...
Yeah, okay. So you're just saying it's not simple production and spread.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that, you know, that's...
Could we factor that in the same ways? Would it be essentially the same, but just more complicated to factor in?
Yes, and you can describe that accurately. So Benny Shilo and Noma Barkai have done a lot of work on this and have described that in quite some quantitative detail. I'm not quite sure what you were driving at.
Yeah,
with
that's about this.
Okay, so to talk about interpretation, I'm going to focus on, you know, the most important tissue in your body, your spinal cord, because it's my favorite tissue. Well, what's the Woody Allen quote? The brain is second favorite organ. Okay, so let me remind you. So I'm going to focus on the ventral spinal cord, and the ventral spinal cord contains somatic motor neurons which innervate your muscles, and also a set of interneurons which coordinate motor output. So innervate motor neurons and innervate themselves to create neural circuits which allow us to coordinate motor output. And that those neural circuits depend on the production of the right number of neurons in the right place early in development. And the organization principle here, the sort of patterning axis, is along the ventral to dorsal. So ventral is your belly, dorsal is your back, the ventral to dorsal axis. And it involves the allocation of proliferating progenitors, neural progenitors, into domains of molecularly discrete domains, each of which is identifiable by the combination of transcription factors it expresses. And this pattern of gene expression depends on hedgehog, which is a secreted protein, produced by the notochord underlying the neural tube and the floor plate of the ventral midline.
Sorry, I mean it's accessory to the concept, but I've missed which organism are you talking about?
So this is in fact chick embryos, but if you look in any vertebrate, you'll see pretty much the same expression pattern. And so some of the data I will be showing you is from chick, some will be from mouse, and it will actually be very difficult just from looking at the images to tell which is which. If you look at human neural tube at the equivalent stages, so in human this would be between 3 and 4 weeks after fertilization, you see a very similar pattern of gene expression. Okay, so this pattern of neurogenesis depends on generating this pattern of gene expression, and that pattern of gene expression depends on hedgehog produced from the ventral pole. So there's several pieces of evidence which supports the idea that hedgehog is acting as some kind of graded signal to establish this pattern. I just want to give you one example of this. And this comes from using a sort of ex vivo primary culture model in which we can dissect out from early embryos a little piece of neural tissue and then culture that ex vivo and tissue culture in defined conditions. And to those explants we can add recombinant hedgehog at different concentrations. So we take one of those explants, just culture it, and look at gene expression 24 hours later in the absence of any added hedgehog. Then the majority of cells in those explants express this gene, PAX7, which is characteristic of progenitors normally found in the dorsal neural tube. If we add a moderate concentration of hedgehog, so 1 nanomolar hedgehog, PAX7 is repressed, and instead most of the cells express this red gene, OLIG2, which is found in the middle of the ventral neural tube. By contrast, if we culture in the presence of 4 nanomolar hedgehog, so fourfold higher, then instead of OLIG2, most of the cells express NKX22, characteristic of progenitors in the very ventral neural tube, just adjacent to the source of hedgehog itself. So this looks like a classic kind of morphogen response. And indeed, we can use this assay to quantify the number of cells expressing particular markers in response to different concentrations. So you can see in the absence of hedgehog, PAX7 is expressed. Then low concentrations of hedgehog repress PAX7, moderate concentrations of hedgehog induce OLIG2, and high concentrations induce NKX22. And notice at the concentrations which induce NKX22, you've repressed the expression of OLIG2. Yeah.
And this is in the explant model.
Yeah.
And how do these concentrations compare to the in vivo concentrations?
So that's difficult to say because it's not possible to directly measure the in vivo concentration. And of course, we're using recombinant hedgehog in vitro, which may have different biological activity to in vivo.
And how much of a morphogen effect would you get with VNP on the same sample?
So if you can do similar experiments, but looking at markers which divide the dorsal neural tube, and you see a similar thing. I think we have much better control over hedgehog than we do with BNP, but certainly different concentrations of hedgehog do the same thing. I'm not going to get into this, but so BNP emanates from the dorsal neural tube and forms an anti-parallel gradient with hedgehog, and you can actually see interactions between those two signals. So if you add a constant concentration of hedgehog and titrate in BNP, you move from ventral back towards dorsal and vice versa. So this looks like a classic kind of morphogen, and indeed, if we just look at the distribution of hedgehog protein in the spinal cord, so this is using an antibody against hedgehog protein and just measuring fluorescent intensity along the patterning axis, what you see, unsurprisingly, is a ventral high to dorsal low fluorescent intensity gradient, so sonic hedgehog gradient, which we can fit with an exponential, which gives you some idea. So lambda here is the characteristic decay length, so it's about 20 microns. So the cell diameter in the neural tube is about 4 or 5 microns in diameter. So you're getting a decreasing gradient, and then that correlates with gene expression. So NKX22, which required the higher concentration in vitro, is in the region where you see the higher concentrations of hedgehog. Conversely, OLIG2 is in the regions where you measure lower concentrations of hedgehog. Okay, so this looks all very straightforward and simple, but of course there are several complications. So now I want to get into some of the complications and then come back and summarize again. So one complication is that the tissue is growing and the gradient is changing, or the production of hedgehog is changing over time. So these are all to the same scale, and they represent the period of time where that pattern is forming. So you're increasing the length of the dorsal neural, the ventral to dorsal length of the neural tube, about 3 or maybe 4-fold during this period of time. In addition, you can see that the production of hedgehog is changing over this period of time as well. So again, if we measure the hedgehog distribution and fit exponentials to that distribution, we see that decay length stays. There's no obvious change in decay length over this period of time, but the amplitude, so the amount of hedgehog being produced, increases quite considerably over that time. So we put those two things together. So the concentration of hedgehog is changing, but also the relative position of cells within the gradient is changing due to growth. So it means that a cell at any particular position in the neural tube is being exposed to a changing concentration of hedgehog over time. Moreover, if we look at the genes which are characteristic of those different dorsal ventral positions, we also see changes over time. So again, this is sort of the same time window. And what you can see is the sort of gradual emergence of patterns. So initially you're seeing the red gene, so OLIG2, the medium response gene, induced first more ventrally, and then the higher response gene being induced, and you see this sort of wave of gene expression through the neural tube. Yeah?
So you're saying the thing is changing in shape, but where are the new cells coming from?
Like, so they're proliferating. So there's uniform proliferation.
Okay, so this is real, like, shifts of domains across the field.
Yeah. Okay, so there's some complications here. There's dynamics to gene expression going on. Yeah.
So is there increase in production because your cells produce hedgehog, or because each individual cells have a higher rate of production?
Both things are going on. So so initially hedgehog is produced solely from the notochord, but then you can see just slightly after that, hedgehog is induced within cells in the floor plate. Those cells proliferate, albeit at a slower rate than the rest of the neural tube. So you increase the size of the floor plate, the source of hedgehog, but you can also see, I guess it's a bit low resolution, but you can also see an increase in fluorescent intensity as well. So it looks like there's increased production of hedgehog and the size of the source is increasing. Okay, so then there's sort of another related complication, that the duration of signaling is also important for gene expression. So now this is going back to the in vitro system where we're controlling the concentration, so we don't have the complication of the source, the amplitude of the signal changing. So here we're exposing those explants to the high concentration of hedgehog 4 nanomolar, which I showed you at 24 hours induced the high response gene NKX22. But if we look at 12 hours, then instead of NKX22, we see transient expression of the low response gene, OLIG2. So we see a transition from OLIG2 expressing cells. So OLIG2 is induced more rapidly by the high concentration of hedgehog, peaks at about 12 hours or so, then declines at the same time as the high response gene NKX2-2 is being induced. So that suggests a sequence of events, and we can further confirm that in vivo by actually lineage tracing cells in vivo that had ever expressed the OLIG2, the low response gene. So using a Cre within the OLIG2 locus and crossing that to mice which have an indelible marker, so a FLOX, LACZ, so any cells which have expressed Cre will remove the FLOX, allowing expression of LACZ from a constitutive enhancer. So any cell that has expressed OLIG2 will continue to produce LACZ even if OLIG2 is switched off. So if we look at, if we lineage trace then cells which have expressed OLIG2, in addition to the cells which are currently expressing OLIG2, we see the lineage trace in all of the cells ventral to the OLIG2 domain. And those are the cells which are expressing NKX2-2. So in vivo, as in vitro, we're seeing this sequence of events. So cells are initially inducing the lower response gene, then switching to induce the high response gene. Okay. All right, so far I've just been talking about extracellular hedgehog, but of course what the nuclei, what gene expression depends on is the intracellular signal transduction. And so this is all you need to know about hedgehog signaling. So hedgehog binds to an extracellular transmembrane protein patched that relieves repression on another transmembrane protein smoothened, allowing smoothened to signal intracellularly. So in the absence of hedgehog, in the absence of smoothened activity, the transcription effectors of hedgehog signaling, the Gli proteins, CI is the equivalent in Drosophila, the Gli proteins are proteolytically processed to form transcriptional repressors. In the presence of hedgehog, smoothened is activated, and that proteolytic processing is inhibited, allowing the accumulation of full-length Gli proteins, which are able to then transactivate target genes. So the effect of hedgehog signaling is to reduce Gli repressor and increase Gli activator activity. So we can measure, we can now, instead of measuring hedgehog protein, we can measure intracellular signaling using reporters of Gli activity. So these are just very simple reporters in which we can catalyze Gli response elements to either GFP, or in this case, this is also GFP effect. So here we're looking at the response of an explant transfected with this reporter, looking at what happens when we add hedgehog to this. So what you can see is that you get very bright cells rapidly within a few hours of adding hedgehog, but then you see a decline in levels of hedgehog signaling, levels of Gli activity over time. So this isn't because you're using up the ligand in the media. If we take that media and add it to a new explant, that media still contains sufficient hedgehog to activate signaling again. So there's some kind of adaptation going on. We heard about that earlier in the week. So with hedgehog signaling as well, we're seeing this adaptation. So do we see this in vivo? So we can make transgenic mice containing the same reporter and look at the activity of this reporter in vivo. So just if we look at the sort of the overview of the mice, we see reporter activity in the tissues where hedgehog signaling is active. So in the ventral neural tube, in the ventral somites, at these stages of development. So we can look at this in more detail by just measuring fluorescent intensity along the dorsal ventral axis at carefully staged embryos to look at the dynamics of signaling over time. So this is just looking at GFP at different positions along the axis. So this is a bit complicated, but this graph is developmental time. So this is the embryonic developmental time window in which we're seeing pattern formation. each of these lines represents a different position from 0% of the ventral midline to 100% of the dorsal midline. So this is ventral to dorsal. And then we're plotting GFP intensity. So if we look at any one particular developmental time point, we see a ventral high to dorsal low gradient. But if we look over developmental time, we see that the level of signaling is changing. We see this sort of rapid increase in level of signaling to a peak quite early on, and then a decrease in the level of signaling in cells over time. So we think about this from a perspective of a cell somewhere in the neural tube. That's having to interpret these changing dynamics of signaling during time. So somehow it's using that information to acquire the right gene expression. So we've got the measurements of the sonic gradient itself, so those fluorescent intensity pictures of the increasing amplitude of the sonic gradient, and those glee activity, the GFP intensity. So we can look at the relationship between those two in vivo. And we're looking again over this developmental time window from early stages to later stages of development. So if we look at the early stages, what you can see is that at those early stages,
How long does proliferation remain uniform? Does it stay for this entire window, or does it slow?
So proliferation slows over this time window, but uniformly.
Right.
So you don't see spatial differences in proliferation. Okay. What you do see is the onset of neuronal differentiation, which happens at around about this stage here, so just after the peak of signaling. So the effect of differentiation will be to remove neural progenitors from the proliferating pool to become post-mitotic neurons. So that has the effect of removing cells from, which is why you don't see exponential increase in the length of the neural tube. In fact, you see it sort of
lessening. Sure, but then you would expect your glee reporter to decrease regardless of, patterning. It would just be that you remove.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't explain this. So this, so if we, you can see, this is good. So what, there's an organization to this, in fact. So the progenitors are, apical is in the inside, basal is in the outside here. So the progenitors actually remain on the apical side of the epithelium. And newly generated neurons move in a medial to lateral direction. So actually here, where you see no OLIG2 expression, is where the earliest generated motor neurons, post-mitotic motor neurons, are situated. And we're measuring in the progenitor domain. So we're ignoring, so we're not affected by the fact you're sort of diluting, effectively diluting. Yeah. Okay. So if we look at early time points, what you can see is that the peak amplitude of hedgehog protein itself is relatively low, but you have high levels of GFP, high levels of glee activity. Over time, you see the peak amplitude of hedgehog increasing, yet the level of glee activity is decreasing. So that's just, again, saying that we're getting these adapting dynamics of hedgehog signaling in vivo. So what we're seeing is this kind of thing going on. So what's the mechanism behind that? I'm not going to get into that today, but there's several possibilities. One obvious possibility is negative feedback, and there's a well-described negative feedback within the pathway itself. So patched, which, as you remember, is a hedgehog receptor, but a negative regulator of the pathway, is also a transcriptional target of glee activity. So hedgehog signaling induces glee activity, induces patch, which is forms a negative feedback loop. So that could account for this decrease in signaling over time. But there's other potential mechanisms as well, and we've discussed this not so long ago. In addition to this patch feedback, there's possibilities within the signaling pathway itself, which could contribute to that adaptation. And of course, there's other possible mechanisms as well. But I don't want to get into that today. So So what is a what's sort of the summary then for the dynamic? So one way of thinking about this is what cells are doing is converting a concentration of hedgehog into a duration of intracellular signaling. So higher the concentration of hedgehog, the longer the duration of signaling, because the adaptation takes longer. And then if I try and sort of summarize these dynamics, what I've shown you so far. So what I've shown you is that you see this sort of sequential induction of gene expression, so it's these sort of waves of gene expression from ventral to dorsal over time. At the same time, you've got some complicated dynamics of glia activity, which increase rapidly but then decline, even as you're inducing and maintaining more ventral gene expression. So one way of looking at this then is sort of, if we look at over developmental time versus position, we see a sequential induction of these more ventral domains of gene expression at the same time as we're seeing these adapting dynamics of glia activity. So that's what we would like to understand. So we've got a complicated relationship between hedgehog concentration and intracellular glia activity. Both the level and the duration of signaling are influencing the response of cells. We're seeing this adaptation to glia activity over time, yet we're seeing the sort of reproducible patterns, domains of gene expression emerge in a sharp and accurate manner. So how does that work? So what I'm going to argue is that we can explain this if we think about the downstream target genes themselves. So these are transcription factors, as well as being nice markers for these domains. They're also connected together in a transcriptional network where there are selective regulatory interactions between pairs of these factors. And it's that transcriptional network which is doing the heavy lifting of converting those dynamics of signal into domains of gene expression. So what's the evidence for this? So some of this comes from straightforward developmental genetics. So if we look at pairs of these target genes, we can already see that they form pairs with mutually exclusive expression. So for example, this red gene NKX22, its dorsal limit of expression corresponds to the ventral limit of PAX6 expression. And there's another boundary between these two transcription factors here. So then we can look in mice where we've mutated one or more of those factors. So for example, if we look in embryos lacking PAX6, which are called small eye mice because they have small eyes, then what you can notice is there's no PAX6 protein, but there's a marked expansion in the domain of NKX22 expression. There's no change in hedgehog signaling in these embryos. So this suggests that PAX6 is at least partially responsible for setting the response of NKX22 to hedgehog signaling. And we can do a similar set of experiments where instead of removing particular transcription factors, we can ectopically express transcription factors. So here in red, we've ectopically expressed NKX22 in a region of the neural tube which normally expresses PAX6, and we can see it repressing PAX6, suggesting this kind of regulatory relationship. So we can go further and look at combinatorial removal of transcription factors. So here again, if we focus on NKX22, that dorsal limit of NKX22, so where it corresponds to the ventral limit of PAX6, also corresponds to the ventral limit of OLIG2. In an OLIG2 mutant, we see a small less marked expansion in PAX6, but still some expansion. A more marked expansion in a PAX6 mutant, which you just saw, and concomitantly repression of OLIG2. And notice you maintain that mutual exclusive expression of PAX6, OLIG2 and NKX22. And in a double mutant lacking both OLIG2 and PAX6, now this domain of NKX22 is really quite dramatically expanded. And if we actually measure this new ectopic dorsal limit of NKX22, it corresponds to where you would normally see the dorsal limit of OLIG2. So in the absence of both OLIG2 and PAC6, the response of NKX2-2 to hedgehog signaling, at least from a genetic interpretation, looks like it's responding as OLIG2 normally responds in a wild-type animal. So that suggests, at least genetically, that OLIG2 and PAC6 are determining the response of NK, or allowing the response of NKX2-2 and OLIG2 to be different to hedgehog signaling. So those kind of experiments begin to allow us to generate these little cartoons describing the regulatory relationship between these transcription factors. So I've shown you that hedgehog signaling is required for NKX2-2 and OLIG2. PAC6 is expressed in the absence of hedgehog signaling. And those gain-of-function and loss-of-function experiments allow us to add these repressive interactions. So we can add one additional link to this. So the dorsal limit of OLIG2 is corresponds to the ventral limit of Iroquois-3. So if we look at these four transcription factors, we have a transcriptional circuit that looks something like this. Hedgehog signaling is required for NKX2-2 and OLIG2 expression, and then there's a series of repressive interactions between the other transcription factors. And these four transcription factors allow us to define two boundaries at distinct positions within the neural tube. So the dorsal limit of NKX2-2 and the dorsal limit of OLIG2. So the genetics suggests that this circuit is important for controlling this spatial expression. Yeah?
James, so SONIC will not act directly on PAC6?
SONIC does not act directly on PAC6. So it's through the repressive interaction of NKX2-2. So hedgehog is inducing NKX2-2 and NKX2-2 is repressing PAC6.
So that means that only part of the gradient is actually important of the SONIC? So that if you go more dorsal, actually you still have SONIC, but it's not...
So more dorsal than that, then yeah. Hedgehog is required for OLIG2 induction, and OLIG2 is required for the repression of Iroquois.
Oh, yeah. OLIG2 is above. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a related, does BMP interact with any of these?
Yeah. So
on the side?
Right. So the evidence we have is that the influence of BMP extends somewhere into this region here. So there's an overlap in this middle region, would be our evidence. And BMP is feeding into the transcriptional circuit in a similar way, but obviously into distinct components. So you could, you know, imagine, simplistically at least, BMP activating the genes here, which look like they're constitutive.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more complicated than that. So given these transcriptional circuit, this sort of genetic network, we wanted to ask a question. So is this circuit sufficient to explain the spatial temporal patterns of behavior? And if so, how is it working? So to do this, we turn to, yeah.
James, this at some level, is this like this TGF-beta where it's effectively the circuit is taking a time derivative?
Yeah, right, and let's hold that thought because we'll get back to that.
I see, okay.
So the way we've tackled this is to take this circuit and turn it into a dynamical systems model. So to do that, we've sort of made some assumptions, or we have some framework for this. So if we think about... how each gene is regulated, there are three components to regulating any particular gene. So one would be the morphogen input itself through glee activity, which, remember, in the absence of hedgehog is a repressor, in the presence it's an activator. And that would be important for that input would be on NKX2-2 and OLIG2. So in addition to that specific morphogen input, then we hypothesize, and again there's some experimental evidence for this, that there is pan-neural positive input into each of those genes, and the candidate for that is the SOXB family. So these are spatially and temporally uniform, but acting as activators of each of the genes, each of the components of the network. And finally, there is the network itself, so the regulatory interactions defined by this cartoon, and those are repressive interactions where they are. So there's three components for that. So then, given this cartoon, we can turn this into a set of four linked differential, ordinary differential equations, which just describe this network in terms of those putative interactions. So now with this, we're in a position to ask, can we parameterize this system to explain the experimental observations we have?
Are these equations set up such that in the absence of bleed after 72 hours, everything is stable?
Not necessarily. So we parameterize this on the basis. So this is just a system of equations.
If bleed is zero and some of these things are on, they stay on?
I'm going to mention this as well. So that comes back to the bistability within the system. So to parameterize this network, we've collaborated with Chris Barnes at UCL, and he's developed computational tools, optimization tools from sort of the approximate Bayesian computation field to parameterize these quite complicated networks. So I don't think I need to introduce this to you, but it's just a parameter optimization approach. And what we've optimized this for is the objective was to describe the steady state patterns of gene expression, both in the wild type, but also in each of the mutants that I described to you. Yeah.
Do you have proliferation?
No. So this is, and it's not, it's not cellularized, it's a continuum.
Yeah, but I mean, is it expanding?
Not what we've optimized to. Okay, so these are the target patterns, and then this is an output parameterization from that optimization.
So this is taking the thing at one time point?
Exactly. So this is just optimizing to what we think of as the steady state point of the system. So there's no steady state. So we're optimizing it to, so the pictures I've been showing you, which are equivalent to E10.5 embryos, these are sort of the picture of E10.5 embryos, if you like. So, a cartoon version of that. So, okay. So I think, I can't remember how many parameters there are in this, but there's sort of 14 or so parameters. So one of the nice things about the ABC, the approximate Bayesian computation optimization, is it doesn't give you just a single set of parameters, but it gives you posteriors, so ranges of parameters which fulfill the objective criteria. And so that's what we got out of this. So just immediately by looking at these posteriors, we can start to make some interpretations. We can see what's going on a little bit. So for example, this parameter here, which is actually the repression of Iroquois on NKX22, you can see this can take pretty much any value, so that's pretty much unconstrained. Whereas other parameters are much more constrained, required to have certain values and within certain ranges as well. Moreover, within this framework, as well as the marginal posteriors, we can also look at the joint distributions of the posteriors to ask if there's particular relationships between parameters. So if one parameter is high, does another have to be high as well? Those kind of things.
Steve. I'm a bit confused because this hedgehog signaling is dynamic.
So we're ignoring the dynamics at the moment, and we'll get back to that in a second.
Does the climbs at different times give you different estimations? So do you repeat the method on a different time?
So this is sort of a cartoon version of our objective here, right? So we haven't optimized it to, we've optimized it to an interpretation of the data rather than the data itself.
I guess the question of well, because your patterns are evolving.
Yeah.
Whether the same parameters reveal different stages of the pattern or only.
Yeah, so that's coming to that. So we've got a set of parameters here. So yeah, so the joint distribution. So there wasn't anything particularly interesting here. But what we do have now is a set of parameters. So we can just take from within these ranges and now re-simulate the model. And so we can simulate across a simulated ventral to dorsal gradient, which is from high levels of glia activator activity, where you have high levels of hedgehog signaling, decreasing activator, increasing repressor, the dorsal neural tube. And consistent with the objective, with the optimization working, we get the expected stripes of gene expression. So ventrally NKX22, in the middle, a stripe of OLIG2, and then dorsally PAC6 and IROQUA3. We can also ask, is this accurately recapitulating the genetics? So in silico, we can do a knockout. We can knock out PAC6. And what you see is expansion of NKX22, reduction of OLIG2. Again, that's what we asked for in the optimization because it would fit with the experimental data. And in addition, if we remove both PAC6 and OLIG2, now you get a much more expanded domain of NKX22, which covers the region in the simulation that would normally express both NKX22 and OLIG2. Yeah?
And when you're doing that, this is the same range of parameters as in the wild type, or you retrain?
This is taking... Our training was on a set of objectives which include the mutants, and this is the posterior distributions of those, the parameters we got out of that training.
Oh, but the mutants are also in the training.
So this isn't surprising, this is just saying that the optimization works.
Okay.
Yeah. So what was more satisfying to us was that these parameters also gave us the temporal responses, even though we didn't ask for that in the optimization. So if we take a parameterization of that model and look at the dynamics of the response, so if we challenge with, so if we take effectively a level of glia activity, which is ventral, and look at how the model behaves over time, what you see is that the long time you get NKX22, which is what we trained it on, but you always see a transient OLIG2. So you always see that induction of or a transient OLIG2 before you get NKX22 in any when you use any level of signaling that will end up giving you NKX22. And if you remember, that's what we were seeing in the experimental data, a transient induction of OLIG2 prior to expression of NKX22.
So how do you deliver hedgehog now in a step function, or is there...
In this particular... Yeah, so can you hold that one more slide? Okay, so how do we think about this? So if we look at the both the sort of steady state, the spatial behavior and the temporal behavior, we can begin to describe this. This is sort of a cartoon of the phase space, if you like, of the behavior of this system over time with different levels of glia activity. So the initial conditions in the model are for IROQUA3 and PAC6 to be on. So what you see from this then is that to get, so if you use a constant, a step function of a low, moderate level of glia activity, you'll end up in an OLIG2 state, you'll turn on OLIG2. Conversely, if you use a higher level of glia activity, you will get NKX22, but it will take longer and you will transiently see OLIG2 expression. So you can't, this circuit means that you can't distinguish the spatial and temporal response. They're both linked by the logic of these regulatory interactions. Moreover, if you now begin to think about the different dynamics of signaling, this also describes how they will behave over time. So you can see how adapting responses would give you particular outputs from this. Does that make sense?
that hedgehog signaling is disappearing over time. So
right.
How the cell fate are
yeah. Okay, so let's think about that. So glia activity is dynamic and reduces over time. So if we look at the in silico model and ask how that behaves, what is obvious, you know, in retrospect, of course, is that all of these cross-suppressive interactions give you bistability and hysteresis. So again, so just intuitively, if we think about just looking at NKX2-2 levels with different amounts of glia activity, initially, if you start from NKX2-2 being off, then the repressors of NKX2-2 are on, iricosidase PAX6, OLIG2, so it requires a sufficient level of glia activity to turn NKX2-2 on. So once you have NKX2-2 on, then its repressors are repressed, and it's repressing its repressors, so it's easier to maintain it. So you get this hysteretic
curve. I don't understand how you get it from fitting the static picture. I mean, this, how you would get this.
So I think that's my argument about that you can't separate out the temporal response, the dynamics, from the spatial pattern. So we just fitted to the spatial pattern, but we ended up seeing this behavior. So again, so relating this back to in vivo, I mean, we don't know how much bistability there is in vivo. I mean, we have done experimental tests.
What I find surprising is that when the activity is going down, you need to maintain the pattern, the right region of bistability. I find it a bit odd that it comes out from fitting the static picture.
So I guess I couldn't argue that we have parameters which explain exactly what's happening in vivo. What I would argue is that this provides a plausible explanation. And by tuning those parameters, you can, of course, tune the width of this bistability.
Do you have any idea about degradation rates of these proteins? Do they are they within the time interval when you're seeing a decrease in G activity?
So experimentally we've started to measure some of those parameters. We don't have high confidence in those measurements yet. But the transcription factors, their half-life is of the order of a few hours. And that's because, as you're probably anticipating, the dynamics of this is mainly set by the half-life of these proteins.
So just to come back to the general point, because I want to mention, so the transient expression of was only 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was in the explant experiment, not in you.
So we can see it both? In
both.
Yeah.
But that was my question. If you have a step function of this, then normally that goes indeed with the adaptation. But what happened in the animal, right, is that you have a ramp of expression.
Yeah,
of
so like this.
And in that case, normally what happens is that you don't go for adaptation, but you have a sustained level, which is just the derivative in time of your ligand.
But this, I'm not sure what your question is.
Therefore, you know, because in the animal you have a ramp, have a step function.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that also gives you the adaptation.
But you're just sort of trawling your way through this phase space in some kind of routes, right? So the ramp would, so if cells are exposed to increasing concentration of hedgehog, there would be a, depending again on the rate at which you're changing, then you would see either increase in signal or a less increase. So I guess this is what you're talking about, is this kind of idea where if the rate of increase slows sufficiently, then adaptation will not allow you to increase further and you'd have a sustained or declining level of signal. Okay, so we did an experiment about hysteresis, which I'm not going to bore you with, but some experimental evidence for that. It also explains some other experimental observations which had previously been difficult to understand. So again, this is a bit of detail, but there are 3 glee proteins in vertebrates, and glee3 happens to be the major contributor to glee repressor activity. And surprisingly, when you knock out Gli3, or unsurprisingly, as it's a major oppressor, you see increased levels of Gli activity, so predominantly coming from Gli2 in a Gli3 mutant, but you don't see a noticeable effect on pattern formation, which is surprising. But But when you think about this kind of fate, if you've got a big increase in Gli activity, but for an insufficient period of time, you still won't fall into the NKX22 state. So again, I think this could begin to explain this sort of transient increase in Gli activity could be buffered by the network. So Manav, I think this question about, what was your question?
Question was, I guess, related to Eric's stuff, which is basically, can I just think of the time derivative of the morphogen signal that a cell is exposed to, is that the relevant, is somehow that the relevant thing to explain?
Yeah, so I would argue it's the transcriptional network which is doing that math.
Which is doing that, yeah, right. But, okay.
Yeah.
In your model, can you get all of the pattern just with two different responses? I mean, basically, we're talking about direct responses. Hedgehog morphogen, you have a low concentration, short duration, and a high concentration. It's basically two different responses.
Yeah, so.
And that can give you levels of the whole pattern.
Yeah, so. Try that question again, sorry.
Well, you know, if you think about the number of different gene expression profiles that depend upon hedgehog, you actually have like five different.
Yeah, and so we're talking about these two boundaries here. So I'm not trying.
The network give you all five or six different.
So this particular, these four components, give you this.
Only those two.
So one thing to on that idea is that, so remember some of those in our optimization, some of those parameters were unconstrained, and that may be because we've subsetted out a small component of this network, and if we were to start to add additional members of the network which are responsible for additional boundaries and interact with these proteins, we would start to see more constraint on some of those as well.
I haven't understood your time coordinate in your so to speak phase diagram. If you in the mathematical model simply either gave your system a step in morphogen to some defined level, or you let it ramp up very slowly and then held it at that defined level, is there a difference in the outcome?
So, I mean, this is, it would basically look at this. Time.
This is how long it's exposed, or the...
This is time of Gli activity. This is a simplification because of the bistability in there, right? You can't really draw it in two dimensions,
so
but it is.
Think of this as you make a step in Gli up to the time of the y-axis, and you sit there and you wait, which is not the same as saying if I ramp up slowly in time and then sit and wait.
That was my question.
But it's, you know, it's about the dynamics of this network, isn't it? Which is sort of summarized in this diagram here, with the caveat that the phase diagram will change in time because of the bistability and the network itself.
My understanding of this set of equations is if I ramp up slowly and then held it fixed for a long time, I would see the same picture irrespective of that slow initial ramp up.
Yes, that's right.
And it's not seeing the initial rate of ramp up. Doesn't care. Who cares about?
Right.
What
yeah. Yes. And that's so. In this particular model, it's sort of an autonomous model, right? We haven't described the hedgehog signaling aspect of that at all. You're plugging in the hedgehog signaling. You're not describing the dynamics of hedgehog signaling. Okay, so I can go on for another 5 minutes, or I can stop now.
If you have till 12, so
okay.
Another 5 minutes will be fine. We've got time for questions.
Okay.
Can I ask, are you experimentally able to change the gradient, not remove hedgehog, but can you flatten it?
So I guess the X-planter is a flattened gradient, so that's a bath application at the ligand.
I'm wondering if in vivo you can, what I'm really wondering about is what do you think of the tethered wingless and DPP nanobody?
Thank you for that. So I think that this explains that.
Okay.
So, you know, so you could have, you can have exactly the same behavior, so, you know, so you can think of your y-axis here as classic morphogen, so different levels, different amounts of the morphogen are giving you different responses, and you can think of the x-axis as a temporal morphogen. So different times of exposure will, you know, if you have a high level of the signal for a different period of time, you'll get different responses. So the John Paul Vincent, the wingless type experiment, again, you know, so from the perspective of the nucleus, from the the cell doesn't know whether it's been exposed to different concentrations at different times. It's just wandering through this phase portrait.
Okay. So with this dynamical systems model, would you be... I think the difficulty that a lot of people have had with the morphogen concept as a blanket is that it has been interpreted to imply that concentration alone is what determines cell response, but your model includes many more elements than concentration.
Yes.
All right.
So it's a dynamic. So it's the dynamics of the transcriptional network which interprets the morphogen, the ligand exposed to. And this comes back to sort of the question of, which I sort of heard as, what is a morphogen? So, you know, what is a morphogen here? Is it hedgehog signaling or is it the transcriptional network? Okay, so let me finish in the last 5 minutes. So this is just a little bit more sort of theoretical exploration of sort of a component of this circuit. And this is from mainly done by my collaborator at UCL, Karen Page. So if we take out those three, if we remove Iroquois 3 now and just focus on these three transcription factors and the circuitry here, driven by hedgehog signaling. So this, in the full model, we can't get analytical solutions, but if we simplify this, so we convert a couple of these functions to Heaviside functions, now we can get analytical solutions to this and really explore the behavior of this three-gene circuit. So that's what Karen has done. So by making essentially the OLIG2 be on and off, and NKX22 go from on and off, but maintaining a continuous function for PAX6 regulation. So you can now get analytical solutions. So what you can show is that there are three possible steady states in this: one where OLIG2 is on, one where NKX22 is on, or a third possible steady state where there's both NKX22 and OLIG2. And you can so that each of those states are stable when they exist, and you can write down the criteria for their existence. And you can sort of make a biological interpretation here that, you know, as you vary S, you can switch for low levels of signal, low levels of sonic signaling, this would be, all of these states would be PAX6 high. So now with this, we can think about how you transition from one steady state to another. So that would be like going from, in particular, from an OLIG2 to an NKX22 steady state. So that's sort of the transition we're interested in. And we're interested in that transition as the signal, as S, increases. And what we can see analytically, that circuit can give you, that network can give you two possible behaviors in the transition from OLIG2 to NKX22. One where there's an overlap in steady states, and that's what I've already shown you, so by stability, so there's an overlap in steady states. But also, you can see a transition where there's a gap in the steady state, so there's values of signal in which neither B1 or B2, neither OLIG2 nor NKX22 are stable. And in that gap, what you see is oscillations, and you can write down the criteria for those to see that gap. So then with these criteria, with these parameters, we can go back and reparameterize the continuous model and look at the behavior. So this is sort of the behavior you've seen before, where as signal increases, we see initially induction of, actually this is from the heavy side, so anyway, you can see an increase in Olig 2 and then a switch to an NKX22 steady state. If we parameterize the model in which there's a gap in steady states, we see this gap in the between particular signal values where neither Olig 2 nor NKX22 are stable. So then using the parameter values for these two models and looking at the temporal behavior, what we see in the bistable example is transient Olig 2, then stable NKX22. Whereas when there's a gap in the steady states, you see these sustained oscillations. And those sustained oscillations are effectively a repressed oscillation. So looking at the parameters, we can see the distinction between these two behaviors. So for this, what I call the morphogen response, the key parameter is that NKX22 is the strongest repressor in the system. So you initiate in a PAC 6 state, you add hedgehog. So initially, NKX22 can't be induced, Olig 2 can be induced. That starts to repress PAC 6, and then you can induce NKX22, which represses Olig 2. It's a strong repressor, so PAC 6 is maintained off, and you're stuck in an NKX22 high state. By contrast, if this repression is weaker than the double negative feedback here, so effectively a positive feedback, you start in a PAC 6 state, you induce Olig 2, which represses PAC 6, then at some point you flip into an NKX22 state, which represses Olig 2, but now NKX22 is no longer sufficient to repress PAC 6, so PAC 6 comes back on, and you're back at the start of this repressor. Actually, that way, I guess. So we can see that this particular circuit allows us to either have sort of a stable spatial output or oscillations. And indeed, if we look at this, how this would behave in over time. So if we parameterize this with a set of parameters that will give us oscillations and then challenge this with different levels of hedgehog signaling. So at low levels of hedgehog signaling, NKX22 is off. At high levels of signaling, NKX22 is on and stable. And in this intermediate regime, we're seeing oscillations. And in fact, the period of that oscillation depends on the level of signaling. So effectively, you'd see traveling waves across tissue. So by tweaking the relative balance of these parameters, which again, from an evolutionary perspective, you can imagine how that could work. So different cofactors or perhaps different strengths of binding sites, we can flip between a stable spatial pattern and an oscillatory behavior. And we like this idea so much that we decided we had to give this circuit a name. And of course, the only name we could come up with is ACDC. Okay, so that's where I wanted to finish. So I just want to make one additional point.
Yes. Yeah. So this you could actually test experimentally by changing, for example, as you said, the affinity of the binding sites.
Yeah. If you tell me where the binding sites are, I'll do it.
Oh, they're not.
So that's what we're trying to do that at the moment. But of course, identifying the regulatory elements and binding sites is not a trivial.
Oh, I thought you had the regulatory elements.
We do have regulatory elements, but there are multiple regulatory elements for each of the genes, and you have, yeah.
Okay.
It's, okay. So, I mean, those are experiments we are trying, but I'm not going to guarantee they're going to work. I'm not betting on them. Okay, so that's the point I wanted to make. So the idea that this transcriptional network is responsible for giving the spatial and temporal behavior of gene expression in the neural tube. It also has other useful features, such as that hysteresis, to maintain patterns of gene expression, even as the dynamics, even as the level of signaling is declining. And it gives you some buffering of transient changes in signal. And so the only other point I wanted to make is that if we look at other developing system. So if we go back and think about Bicoid and the gap gene system, then many people, so Yogi Jaeger, Manu, John Reinitz, Steve Saul, many others, have come to similar sort of conclusions, or the principles seem very similar in the gap gene system as they do in the neural tube. So Bicoid is regulating a set of transcription factors that form repressive interactions between them. So this suggests that this might be a common theme to the interpretation of morphogens. And indeed, if you look at the gap gene system in even more detail and start to look at the regulatory interactions between the various components of the gap gene system, you can start to imagine that you see AC-DC-like circuits within there. So in fact, the dynamical mechanism may actually be very similar between the neural tube and embryos and Drosophila embryos as well. So let me finish there. So I want to thank the people in my lab that have been responsible for the work. In addition, our sort of long-term collaborators, Chris Barnes and Karen Page, and Ruben Perez at UCL. So we're now the CRIC, and we're going to start recruiting in September. So have your CVs ready. Thank you very much.
So I had a question from an evolutionary point of view. So you said across the vertebrates, or at least across across the vertebrates, that the neural tube broadly the same, but there are some differences. Is there sufficient information to plug those differences in to try and see how your model is fitting? Is it tweaking individual?
I think so. There are several differences between different species. So qualitatively, the pattern looks very similar. However, the time of patterning is different between species. So as I said, in mouse and chick, it's 36, 48 hours. Zebrafish, it's 12 hours. In humans, it's more than 48 hours. So there's some temporal scaling that needs to go on, which again may relate, of course, to half-lives of proteins. But also, there's a spatial scaling as well, so different spinal cords of different sizes. So how much of that is differences in the initial formation of the pattern, how much of that is subsequent elaboration by growth? And that's something that we're interested in as well. In fact, Annie Kachiva, who's recently started a lab in IST in Vienna, that's one of the questions that she's asking.
Now that you have this model and this cartoon of a phase space, where you on one axis you have time and the other you have concentration, are you trying to change this, to see how this phase diagram looks in your explant culture, so that you can actually modify the concentration of HLR and times by washing?
Exactly, and actually that's one of the experiments I skipped over. In fact, we have exactly used the explant system for that purpose and found some evidence to support the idea there's bistability, so we can induce gene expression, then reduce the level of hedgehog signaling, yet maintain the gene expression that wouldn't normally be induced at that level of signal. So I think that's exactly, so the explant's really powerful. The other thing we're doing, which I haven't had time to talk about, is modeling this using the directed differentiation of embryonic stem cells, which has many of the same advantages of explants, but in addition, the ability to create many more much larger amounts of material than you can simply from explanting out of embryos.
So if you go back to the initial slides that you had with the time difference between, you know, Bicoid case or 20 minutes to 4 days, what is the change isn't clear to me. So the biological reaction must be pretty much in the same time scale. So is the case where you need more time simply decision are made, reset, made, reset, made, reset, or you really wait 48 hours before making a decision?
So, I mean, it's when you say decision, what do you mean?
Gene expression patterns.
Yeah, so the gene expression is continuous and dynamic, right? So you're seeing, so what's really surprising to me is seeing this complex transcriptional network and the genetic evidence that in the gap gene system, that this is also crucial for the interpretation of Bicoid signaling. and this is all happening within a small number of minutes. Whereas what I'm talking about is, again, maybe quite a similar transcriptional network that is elaborated over several hours to a day or so. So, I don't have an answer. I think it's a fascinating question of, is it simply, the half-life of proteins here are minutes and the half-life in the neural tube is hours, and that will give you the difference, or what explains things? I don't know. Did you want to comment on that?
No. There is no rules for interaction between cells.
I mean, there's plenty of possibilities. There's not great evidence. Yeah. So, absolutely. And, of course, there's an additional aspect to sharp boundaries. There's the pure response to the morphogen itself. But in addition, there's cell proliferation going on. And that would also tend to degrade the sharpness of boundaries if there was nothing countering that. So there's possibilities that differential adhesion or signaling between boundaries could contribute to sharpening, but there's really not very much evidence to support that.
So thinking more generally, I need to know whether when I leave this room, I still believe in the Wolpertian view of the morphogen. So that is the idea that we could have a single molecule that could turn on things at different concentrations. I can see that this is very powerful for integrated signals.
If you have a one-dimensional view of the world, right, you're fine here, right? You can be. But if you want, you can either. So if you're one-dimensional, you can either believe in morphogens or completely deny their existence, right? But I mean, the transcriptional network is saying both is true. I think, I think that's a semantic issue about what is a morphogen.
Well, it is a semantic issue, and I think it's only actually when people use the word morphogen, I prefer the Turing definition. It's a molecule that does something. But that isn't the way the textbooks are working.
And it's not a very precise definition either, right?
Well, no, that's why it's good.
Yeah.
Well, I think if it can be wrong, you should be gloriously wrong.
Is that what you're saying?
Very precise about what you're saying. I mean, I built my career on being successively wrong, gloriously.
It's not a general strategy we could recommend that, I think.
No, on the contrary, it's philosophical, but I mean, the question is, are we ever really right? Or do we make progress by being
wrong in an
interesting way.
Yeah,
I think
it's
called
bold hypothesis. I mean, the very, very strict morphogen hypothesis is it's very old, it's extremely attractive, and for a long time it seemed able to explain a fairly large body of data.
But I mean, that definition of a morphogen sort of arose over several decades. It was never really there to.
I mean, I think initially it was extremely vague, almost as vague as what you're suggesting, and then it acquired some other specific, maybe too narrow connotations. And then too many data points just couldn't fit into it. And this, to me, makes a lot more sense. It's less hung up on a particular word.
I like that it is that if you take that very strict concentration dependence, single-dimensional axis, it's not that that is wrong, it's just that there's a bigger space around it.
Has this changed the way that you use the term morphogen, that you write about these things? Or?
Yeah, so I like the idea that the morphogen is a transcriptional network.
Yeah, so it's that, a morphogen system, not a
precisely.
Protein that
so it's an emergent behavior of the system.
Sort of like the gap genes or the parallel genes in the insects. The gap genes were defined by the mutant, but in other insects we're finding that was too narrow.
Yeah.